Hello, listeners. This is the Heretics Hour on Monday, October 5th, 2015, and I'm Carolyn Yeager. There has been a lot going on recently, and it is not good. Not good for European people, the survival of European culture, or for the sovereignty of European nation-states. But the worst part is that most Europeans are more concerned with their personal sense of moral correctness than with their survival. They have been corrupted by decades of brainwashing. That's indoctrination in school and via media, mainly, to believe in something called humanity, that we are all a part of, and that we should see all members of humanity as brothers and sisters and mothers, etc., under the skin. This is considered the ultimate moral high ground. Just as an aside, that term humanity has been used quite a bit with Holocaust propaganda, and I noticed back when I was doing some work on Holocaust organizations in the United States that many of them had the word humanity in their names. So this is something that Jews promote, this whole idea that we are all one humanity. And this is also a Mother Teresa outlook on life. It's not strange, then, that the German weekly news magazine Der Spiegel created for a recent cover the face of Angela Merkel done up as Mother Teresa, as Mutti Merkel, or Mommy Merkel, as the Germans call her. This past Saturday, Germany celebrated the 25th anniversary of their reunification after 45 years of being divided into East and West Germany, and totally separated into opposite and warring political systems. The worst government that ever existed on the face of the earth, in my opinion, the United Soviet Socialist Republics, or Soviet Union, took over the eastern portion of Germany along with the Baltic and Balkan states, and Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, etc. I might have forgotten some there, under Joseph Stalin's communist terror reign. And it was the United States and the United Kingdom that helped Stalin do it, let's not forget. This was at the close of the barbaric world war called World War II. And here is where the so-called modern world that we exist in today began, right there in 1945. At that time, there were 2.5 billion human beings in the world. Today, there are 7.3 billion. That's a 3 times increase in only 70 years. And politically, the world is nothing like it was then. This will be the subject of this program. First, to set the stage, let's look at the words of Chancellor Merkel and President Gauck of Germany on Reunification Day, which was Saturday. Joachim Gauck gave the keynote speech. And he said, "Today we celebrate the courage and self-confidence of that time," meaning the time of the reunification in 1990. He says, "Let us use this memory as a bridge." He's trying to tie together what took place at German reunification with this influx of refugees that they want Germans to help to integrate successfully into the German state. He said, quote, "In 1992, there was the legitimate question, are we up to this challenge? Then, too, there was no example from history to follow. And nevertheless, millions of people took on the national task of unification and made Germany into a country that was more than the sum of its parts." Well, where is the connection there? Because as you would expect, East and West Germans had been one people for 1,000 years, with only a break of 45 years, and even that made it difficult for them to work together. Even now, after 25 years, they're still having some differences and difficulties. So it has no resemblance to unifying Syrians, who are Arab and Muslim, of a different race and religion, into the German society. He said it would take time for new arrivals to adjust to a different social order, quote, "which is not infrequently in conflict with their own traditional norms," unquote. Well, I guess he's admitting that there will be frequent conflict over what is considered traditional ways of living. So what then is the purpose of bringing people with conflicting traditions together? Well, we'll see. That's the overall globalist agenda, is why they're doing it, which has no meaning for what's good for the German people at all. He said, quote, "We have seen that the change in attitudes toward refugees and immigrants can only come through a long and also contentious learning process." You know, he's admitting how difficult this is going to be, and it's not going to work either. So therefore, why do it? Again, the purpose is not mentioned, the purpose for why they're doing it. This recognition, he says, should make it easier to respect the experiences of other nations, which are just meaningless words. And of course, they are presenting this as the purpose for doing this is the higher morality that's involved in it. That's how they're presenting it. Germans are a moral people, and we need to show the world what a good people we are because of our terrible past. Of course, that's the reason. We're still overcoming that. And finally, they say he stressed that Germans' values were, quote, non-negotiable, and he condemned anti-Semitism and discrimination against women and homosexuals. There you have, again, the globalist agenda. And here's a quote, "Tolerance for intolerance is not acceptable," he said. Meaning there is only tolerance in Germany for the values that they have decided are German values. And if some Germans don't agree with their values, then those Germans are un-German. That's the judgment they put on them. So talking about tolerance and intolerance, what are they going to do when all these young Muslim men start acting on their values? Are they going to deport them? Well, I would say this is just part of the long-range effort to make everyone into identity-less, malleable consumers, and I think many of them really believe or accept that that is the best way forward for a peaceful world. This is going to be a challenge that Germany is not going to win, in my opinion. But now here we have Merkel, who talked to reporters. She didn't give a speech, but she talked to some reporters ahead of time, and she said, quote, 25 years on, we are facing great challenges with the issue of refugees, unquote. Well, why are they facing great challenges? Once again, it's only because they've chosen to do this. You know, Hungary's Viktor Orban represents the same view of Europe, which says, we don't need to do this. We don't need to allow these people into Europe. So then Chancellor Merkel says, now, too, we Germans will not be able to solve the problem on our own, but only with Europe, with a fair division of the burden and with the rest of the world, unquote. Donald Trump has described how you solve this problem, but that's not what they intend to do. They are insisting, and Merkel is insisting, as the leader of Europe somehow. Up until this Greek crisis, she was not trying to act like the big boss of Europe, but suddenly she's come out as accepting that that's her role, and she has the power behind her, and she's pushing this globalist agenda now, and pushing it hard. So she's insisting that we will do this, that we will take in all these Arab Muslim refugees, and we will work it out, and we will succeed, and you damn well better do it. Because this is what's in store for you, and you're not going to get out of it. You're not going to get out from under it. And we'll see that this is not something we should be shocked about, because this has been on the burner, and this has been moving forward ever since 1945. The article in Der Spiegel magazine that featured the cover image of Angela Merkel with the Indian-style nun-type veil, wrote about her that she is now sending a message against knee-jerk xenophobia. They say that the conservatism of Bavaria's Lederhosen Brigade and some of her own party colleagues in her conservative Christian party has always remained a foreign concept to Angela Merkel, and this has never been more apparent than it is now. 10 years in office have clearly changed Merkel. She now has the strength and independence to state her opinions more stridently, even if it earns her the opprobrium of her allies. So she is trying to transform Germany into a moral superpower in Europe. She is showing a lot of hubris. Merkel now speaks very much about Europe and in terms of Europe, and very little in terms of Germany, if you've noticed those words in her speech. She speaks of Europe, not of Germany, most of the time. So there again, I think she's looking to a higher consensus. She's looking to Europe to support her, and she's looking to Europe to give her a Nobel Peace Prize for being the great uniter of Europe in some way. We'll see. We'll see, but I am very interested in how this turns out and what happens from here. Also in this same Spiegel article, and of course Spiegel is the left-wing, actually communist-leaning political position magazine, they write that Merkel has never had sympathy for the far right. In 2003, she ejected Martin Homan from the Conservatives' parliamentary group because he had played upon anti-Semitic cliches in a speech. Over the years, Merkel's position has become more entrenched. In internal discussions, she has rejected any attempts to posit a psychological explanation for far-right extremism in Germany's east. She has no understanding for it whatsoever. She says she is proud of the Germans who are helping the refugees, and she is totally unsympathetic to those the more they are against the refugees, even though they are Germans. So Angela Merkel has become a European in the European Union sense of the term. This article also says this: the Chancellor gave an oath to devote herself to the good of the German people, but she is now risking her entire political capital for Syrians, Iraqis, and Afghans who are in need of help. Still, there are indications that Merkel's refugee policy is driven more by her sentiment than she is willing to admit. One person who has known her for a long time says that it really did get to her that during the Grexit crisis, she was portrayed as the second coming of the Nazis. Okay, she didn't like that. She didn't like herself being portrayed as a hateful and a selfish person. So enough of German Reunification Day for now, and the question that I think needs to be asked is, how did we get into this insane mess? Because until we know that, we won't be able to get out of it. Some of us know how we got into this insane mess, but we're not doing a good job of presenting that information to all the other members of our race who are being exposed only to the false history and false information that I've already mentioned. We have a number of bloggers who spend time splitting hairs about whether whites are committing racial suicide because of something called white pathology, or whether it is totally the fault of the 2% of Jews in European lands. This argument leads us nowhere and only serves to give the bloggers an inflated sense of their own importance. What we do know is that whites have a problem, and it comes from the distortion of their history, especially beginning at the time of the First World War. Let's see. That war officially started in November 1914. What else was happening around that time? Oh yes, less than a year before, during the U.S. Congressional Christmas break on December 23rd, 1913, the Federal Reserve Act was passed in the Senate, with 27 members having already left for home because they were told the vote would not take place until they returned in January. The Democrats lied, and President Woodrow Wilson signed the bill immediately that very same day, on December 23rd. That set the direction of U.S. politics from then on. Nothing was as it appeared. A secret power moved things in mysterious ways, with a lot of help from the press, as it was called then. Newspapers were king, but film was growing in importance. Jews from Eastern Europe were becoming the major players in both areas. In fact, they became absolute controllers. They knew how to ruin a going concern, then buy it on the cheap, and end up multimillionaires. They had America figured out. So historical revisionism is what is needed, and it has been undertaken since the First World War, but unfortunately, not enough people have gotten the message. Why did our people fall for the liberal teachings of humanitarianism, as I will call it, and guilt for war, famine, and failed third world cultures? We fell for it because we were given and believed in a false history. Since the same people who gained control of the press, now called media, and the film industry also control the publishing industry, including textbooks for schools and universities, and the news media, etc., there was very little chance to correct the history that was everywhere being discharged until the internet came along. So now we have another chance, but are we using it? Well, I don't think we're using it as well as we could. What needs to be hammered home is that two propaganda plays from World War II are the backbone of the world that has been created since, often called the New World Order. These two are the Nuremberg Tribunal and the United Nations. From these two, the basis of the post-racial, eventually borderless world of interchangeable consumers of products was formed. Our whole failure stems from joining our enemies because they were the victors. And by stealing from their victims, they had all the wealth. Most white nationalists and white identitarians of today are ignorant of history in its details, but also the internet has made it possible for every kind of false history to be promulgated along with revisionist history and in sensationalist ways that appeal to the more superficial people among us. Who is still writing and talking about Nuremberg? Vincent Renoir, for one. Carlos Porter used to. He did quite a lot. And I try to as much as I can in both articles and radio programs. Hadding Scott has recently translated from the book by Heinrich Hertel some very good parts about Nuremberg, which are absolutely condemning. The purpose of Nuremberg, among many sub-purposes, was to destroy the political feasibility of nationalism and of racialism among white European people. The United Nations was formed first. Then the tribunals created ex post facto laws against waging war and against excluding people who are different or foreign from one's own national homeland. And much later, the European Union was formed to draw everyone into a Europe without borders. The current migrant crisis is just furtherance of the global engineering that has been going on since 1945. Since it has been steadily growing, we shouldn't be surprised that it has now presented itself so big, so menacing, so unstoppable. It's always been there and getting stronger, but we get complacent when things are quiet for a while. At this point, I want to talk about a gentleman who has played a big role in this transformation. His name is Peter Sutherland. Sutherland was born in 1946 in Dublin, Ireland. On his Wikipedia page, his early and personal life section is empty, something I've never seen before. He says his religion is Roman Catholicism, as are most Irish. If he is not of Jewish ancestry, which I don't think he is, he definitely works for the Jews and is rewarded by them. He was appointed to the European Commission, the executive body of the European Union, in 1985. The youngest European commissioner. From there, he became director general of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which was the GATT, G-A-T-T, and is now the World Trade Organization. Later U.S. Trade Minister and a Jew, Mickey Cantor, accredited Sutherland with being the father of globalization and said that without him, there would have been no WTO. World Trade Organization, which was previously GATT, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. What could be more damning than that, may I ask you, to be called the father of globalization? Now listen to this. Chairing the Uruguay round of the trade talks, Sutherland, quote, employed tactics the likes of which had never been seen before in GATT. he worked to create the sense of unstoppable momentum by mobilizing the press and media and instigating, quote, a more aggressive public relations than the staid GATT had ever before seen, unquote, according to Greg Van Grasteck of the Harvard Kennedy School, who has written a book about it. I remember at that time, the time of the creation of GATT, I was in Mexico, wasn't paying a lot of attention, but I got the impression that this trade deal had to be done, that it was inevitable, there was no way to stop it. I saw the negatives about it, but the arguments were such that it impressed you that we had to go along with the rest of the world. There was no way out of it. It was kind of strange. I remember thinking about it in that way. And here they're saying that this is what Sutherland worked to create, this sense of unstoppable momentum. And of course, this is how the Jews work too. But Sutherland had also been Attorney General of Ireland and Chairman of the European Institute of Public Administration, and he chaired the report on the functioning of the internal market in 1992 for the European Union. It was difficult to find certain dates for him, like when he became chairman of Goldman Sachs International, a position he only stepped down from in June of this year. At the same time, he was chairman of British Petroleum from 1997 to 2009, and he's been the chief financial advisor to the Pope, or really to the Vatican, but they express it as to the Pope. Now, Peter Sutherland is also on the steering committee of the Bilderberg Group and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, who met in Four Seasons Hotel Dublin on May 6 to 10 in 2010, arranged by him. These are all major New World Order think tanks in their own right, and he is a member of all of them. Naturally, he has received national decorations and honorary degrees. In January of this year, he took office as president of the International Catholic Migration Commission. And now I want to read from a news story from BBC News from June 2012, in which Sutherland openly says exactly what they want to happen. It's right in the title. It says, EU should undermine national homogeneity, says UN Migration Chief. It starts out, the EU should, quote, do its best to undermine, unquote, the homogeneity of its member states, the UN Special Representative for Migration has said. Peter Sutherland told peers, that is in the House of Lords, as he was speaking in the House of Lords, and he told them the future prosperity of many EU states depended on them becoming multicultural. So what he's saying is that prosperity requires multiculturalism. And this is what Merkel is saying too. This is exactly what she's been saying recently. And she's actually been saying this for about 5 years. But we don't really believe it when she brings up things like that. We tend to think, oh, she's just talking. It's not, couldn't be. This could be called the new colonialism. Instead of Europeans going to Asian or African countries, these Asians and Africans are coming to Europe and colonizing Europe. Well, how can that prosper Europeans? What is the reasoning? Do they have any reasoning here? Well, going back to the article, Sutherland also suggested the United Kingdom government immigration policy had no basis in international law. Well, bull on international law. But when he said these things, he was being quizzed by the House of Lords EU Home Affairs Subcommittee. That's who he was being quizzed by, which was investigating global migration. And he was speaking to them. This was from June 2012. Then the article identifies Mr. Sutherland as heading the Global Forum on Migration and Development, which I looked up, and it's something that works in cooperation with the United Nations and the European Union in Brussels and brings together representatives of 160 nations to share policy ideas on, of course, migration. Migration and Development. So Sutherland told the House of Lords that, quote, migration was a crucial dynamic for economic growth in some EU nations, however difficult it may be to explain this to the citizens of those states, unquote. Well, there you go. It's like what Gauck was saying Saturday on the reunification day, that even though this was difficult for the people who were having to endure all of this, all of these kinds of changes, it was necessary for economic growth. We can understand that everything that the New World Order cares about is economic. It's all money. They are intending to sacrifice European people's sovereignty and, of course, their racial and national integrity for greater profits in the global world structure, the global world order. The so-called right of self-determination, which was talked about so much during and after World War II. What happened to that? That was a big lie, of course, like the whole thing was a big lie. Sutherland says that an aging or declining native population in countries like Germany or Southern European Union states was the key argument, he said, and he hesitated to use that word because people have attacked it for the development of multicultural states. Well, that's the argument that Merkel uses today. She's taking her points directly from this man who has set the tone and who knew exactly what to say himself. So she's using that same language, and she's just spouting off the words that she's been given. He says this. He said, it's impossible to consider that the degree of homogeneity which is implied by the other argument can survive, because states have to become more open states in terms of the people who inhabit them, just as the United Kingdom has demonstrated, unquote. He's saying that homogeneous states cannot survive. He says they cannot survive in this new world. They have to become multicultural. They have to become heterogeneous. But this is not really an argument that he's putting forth. Is the UK a success story from the point of view of the native people who live there? I don't think so. It's a success story for the global banksters, because it has been doing well economically. Same with Germany. That's all they care about. And the people who they put in place as leaders only care about that also. And that's the crux of the problem right there. Sutherland says, quote, at the most basic level, individuals should have a freedom of choice, unquote. He's speaking about migrants. And he's speaking about the migrant people having a choice of where they want to go and if they want to go somewhere. That it should all be on the individual level. Then he was asked what the EU should do about the fact that employment rates among migrants were higher in the United States and Australia than in European Union countries. His answer to that was, quote, the United States or Australia and New Zealand are migrant societies, and therefore they accommodate more readily those from other backgrounds than we do ourselves, who still nurse a sense of our homogeneity and difference from others, unquote. So he says over and over that it's this sense of homogeneity that is the problem. Now, they tried to get rid of this sense of homogeneity within nations in the creation of the European Union and in the continuing advancements and adjustments that they've made to make it more united and more similar, make everyone more similar, to break down any barriers. But now they're moving into another phase where it's going to be non-Europeans coming in, and the Europeans now need to assimilate all of that. So the goal now is to make it wrong and racist to see yourself as different from others. And this goes right back to the Nuremberg tribunals and right back to the founding principles of the United Nations, which was formed between 1940 and 1945. Quote, who still nurse a sense of our homogeneity and difference from others, And that's precisely what the European Union, in my view, should be doing its best to undermine. Unquote. That's Sutherland, coming right out with it. Our uniqueness and our difference from others must be undermined. Sutherland urged EU member states to work together more closely on migration policy and advocated a global approach to the issue. He criticized the UK government's attempt to cut net migration from its current level to tens of thousands a year through visa restrictions. So he wants no restrictions. And then it says that British higher education chiefs, who are ultimately traitors, want non-EU overseas students to be exempted from migration statistics. So they won't take away from the number that can come. And they said that visa restrictions brought in to help the government meet its target will damage Britain's economic competitiveness. Visa restrictions to keep the lower target that the British government decided it should have would damage Britain's economic competitiveness. So there again, the idea is that migration and migrants are necessary for economic well-being and competitiveness. That's what they're saying over and over again. That's the position. Sutherland said that this policy of Britain's risked their traditional status as a tolerant open society and would be massively damaging to its higher education sector, both financially and intellectually. He said, quote, "It's very important that we should not send a signal from this country," meaning the UK, "either to potential students of the highest quality or to academic staff that this is in some way an unsympathetic environment in which to seek visas or whatever other permissions are required, and I would be fearful that that could be a signal," unquote. This, again, is exactly what Merkel is saying when she says that Germany must have a friendly face and must show a friendly face to the rest of the world, meaning to migrants. They want these migrants to come. Sutherland goes further and calls on EU states to stop targeting, quote, highly skilled, unquote, migrants, arguing that, quote, "at the most basic level, individuals should have a freedom of choice about whether to come and study or work in another country," unquote. So there again, we've already touched on this, but here again, here's where he's saying that we don't want to only be wanting the highly skilled migrants. We want whatever migrants want to come. Whatever migrants want to come, they should be welcomed. And there should be high, high quotas so that we don't have to turn very many of them away. And then he briefed the peers on plans for the Global Migration and Development Forum's next annual conference in November, adding, "The UK has been very constructively engaged in this whole process from the beginning and very supportive of me personally." So if you think there's any way for this latest migrant crisis to be solved or to be stopped, think again, because I don't think there is. They are determined to see this through, and they don't care what the people complain about. They'll just arrest the ones they need to and put them in prison. They'll do whatever it takes, and the news media is totally on their side. And so they present it very sympathetic to the migrants and very unsympathetic to those who don't like it. So that was in 2012. And now, just 2 weeks ago, there was an article on the ECB vice president, the European Central Bank vice president, who was commenting on how Europe's aging society is committing demographic suicide and needs immigrants to keep its workforce from shrinking further. This man is named Victor Constancio. He is Portuguese, but you know, with these people, it doesn't matter what country they're from, because they belong to the European Union upper level, and that's who they're representing. So as vice president of the European Central Bank, this Constancio underlined the European Central Bank's willingness to print more money, but cautioned that printing more money could not single-handedly turn around the Eurozone's economy, which is what they're all interested in, and of Of course, he being a member of the central bank, he would be interested in that. It's natural that that's his job. But he said that this wouldn't do enough. Immigration, though, could help. He is a deputy for ECB President Mario Draghi, and he was addressing one of the factors slowing the region's economy, which he called an aging society and shrinking workforce that is set to reduce further in the coming decade. So this is what they're saying over and over again. And of course, when it comes to their pocketbook and comes to their well-being, Europeans are going to fall for this. They're going to accept what's being said. And they see these leaders as being on their side for the most part. They have a hard time. We all have a hard time seeing our leaders as being really against us. We tend to put out a lot of sympathy and they behave in a sympathetic manner and we fall for it again and again and again because we don't really have a good choice. Otherwise, we don't have any opposite choices that we feel enough confidence in. So this high-level European bureaucrat just continues saying it over and over again. He says, for years, Europe has been doing a sort of collective demographic suicide. And he says, you can't change this demographic trend by promoting more births. That's not enough. He says, it has to be done through immigration. Why? But no, they just say that. It's not that it's true. They just say that. And by the way, this Constancio is 71 years old. So he's past retirement age, but he's still going. And then so he goes on to warn that Europe's economic growth potential was weak due to, again, a shrinking labor market. Now, if there's so much unemployment in Europe, how can there be a shrinking labor market? I don't get it. Is that these people who are unemployed are not employable? Is that it? Are they so bad that nobody wants them for anything? Are they only talking about a shrinking labor market in high-level, high management, or high-tech positions? This is not explained. It's just the same talking points are just repeated again and again. The same words are just repeated. It says he blamed high unemployment for a dramatic backlash against immigration and said that the large number of unemployed people in Europe was destabilizing the continent. Now, this is where I ask then, you know, if there's a shrinking labor market and the solution is immigration, how does that jive with this high unemployment of the native European people? They don't explain it. And then they talk about the unemployment being so high in countries like Spain. They just mentioned that one in particular. And low in a country like Germany. So since they want to see Europe as one entity, then the unemployment in these less competitive countries are screwing the whole idea of the unemployment in Europe because there's not high unemployment in England or in Scotland or in Germany or in Austria like there is in some of the other countries. And this is why uniting people who have differences doesn't work well. And if you can't even unite successfully the people of Europe, how can you unite the people of the whole world or bring Asians and Africans and Middle Easterners into Europe? It's absolutely nonsensical, and that's why they have to force it in this way. They slowly, slowly push, push, push in any way that there's a way to do some more pushing. They do it, and they don't ever explain themselves in an intelligent way. This Constancio then played down the idea of any Eurozone member ever leaving the Euro currency union. He said, quote, there was never any doubt among the majority of member countries that the Euro is irreversible, he said, speaking about the idea of Greece leaving the Euro last summer. And he said, quote, the actual prospects of that happening was never for real, unquote. Well, that's a joke because of course it was for real and of course it can happen and of course nothing is irreversible. So they lie and he's just lying. Now these are all Europeans that I'm talking about and they're a sorry lot. There's nothing to be proud of with these Europeans and nothing to brag about. They're sellouts or they they can tell themselves, and believe it, they don't look at any arguments otherwise, that the only way for peace in the world is for everyone to be more alike and to get rid of all nationalism and people's being against others because they're different. So they can convince themselves or sort of accept that this is right, and so they go along with it, believing that they're doing something good, but they don't look into it. They don't allow themselves to look at the other side of it. They can't, or if they were honest, they wouldn't be able to go along with it. But they do go along with it without feeling bad because they surround themselves with other people who are doing the same thing, and they're all telling themselves how good they are. That's what happens. It's a form of unreality, but the living is good, isn't it? They're living high on the hog, so. And I think Angela Merkel is seriously hoping to get the Nobel Prize for Peace, and I wouldn't be surprised if she does eventually get it. A little more about the Nobel Prizes as we move on here. Okay, I now want to look at the history of the United Nations to show that it comes directly from the World War II victors. It's an outgrowth of World War II. The name United Nations was coined by United States President Franklin D. Roosevelt and first used in something that he called the Declaration by United Nations of 1st January 1942 during the Second World War, when he got representatives of 26 nations to pledge their government to continue fighting together against the Axis powers. Roosevelt declared war on Japan in December 1941. So in January, he was busy organizing all those who he considered to be on the Allies side, and he got 26 of them, and he called them, not in a formal way, but United Nations, Nations United, about what was in this declaration. So this was the first time it was used. Then in 1943, in the Moscow and Tehran conferences, they spoke of an attempt to create a world in which, quote, men of all lands may live out their lives in freedom from fear and want, unquote. Well, no international organization can create such a thing. They cannot guarantee that people can live in freedom without fear and want. It's a big lie from the start, but the aim was to get all nations to support the Union run by the United States, this United Group. In 1944, from August to October, members met in Dumbarton Oaks. They were representatives of the United States, United Kingdom, Soviet Union, and China, those four nations. They actually worked out the proposals to be presented to the group that met later to create the UN Charter. So they were doing this in August to October, late summer, 1944. Of course, the war was not at all over yet, but they were in a hurry to get this done. Or Roosevelt was in a hurry to get it done. In 1945 then, on April 25th, 1945, that was before the war was over, before Germany surrendered, Hitler was still alive. At this time, representatives of 50 countries met in San Francisco in the United States at what they called the United Nations Conference on International Organization to draw up the United Nations Charter. So they had been creating this United Nations organization since 1942, really, or certainly since 1943. And this charter was signed on 26 June 1945, just shortly after the surrender of Germany, and Poland was not represented because of confusion in Poland. When it was able to sign it later, much later, it became one of the original 51 member states. They made that adjustment. On the UN website, they don't even say that John D. Rockefeller Jr. donated the land in Manhattan for the UN building. They don't want to tell you that. But that's what happened. They were looking at different places in the U.S., and Rockefeller donated the land that he owned because they wanted it in Manhattan. And why not? The Jews would have wanted it in Manhattan, in New York City. That's their turf, you know. And then here's a few highlights from things that happened over the years since then with the United Nations. In 1965, the UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And it does seem like there are an awful lot of Nobel Prizes awarded to the United Nations, different groups and committees and so on. So they're, of course, very much allied together. In 1966, the General Assembly stripped South Africa of its mandate to govern Namibia and imposes mandatory sanctions against Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. So they weren't very kind. The United Nations was quite unkind to the white South Africans. In 1969, there was an international convention on the elimination of all forms of racial discrimination. And that came into force at that time, that it was no longer okay for there to be any racial discrimination anywhere. Also in 1969, the ILO, the International Labor Organization, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. In 1975, they held that big World Conference on Women. That was sponsored by the UN, and it was held in Mexico City. I remember that. It sticks in my mind, and I remember it. It wasn't because it was about women, I don't think. It was because they made a lot of noise about it. I mean, it was just in the newspapers and on TV. They talked about it so much. I can recall when that was going on. In 1981, UN High Commissioner for Refugees is awarded the Nobel Prize for the second time for assistance to Asian refugees. UN is very, very big in refugee problems and in migration. In 2005, this is the one that stands out for me. On January 1st, they held a special session of the General Assembly to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the liberation of the Nazi concentration camps. Again, they don't want you to know that this was actually when January 27th was made the official International Day of Commemoration of Victims of the Holocaust. Well, they don't put it to here. They just say it was the 60th anniversary. Well, they coincided. And this petition to make this day of commemoration came from Israel. And there wasn't even a vote. They just said, does anybody object to this? And nobody said they objected. And so then it automatically passed. I mean, it didn't even pass. It went into effect. That's how they do things there, because they're so cowardly when it comes to Jews. They're so cowardly in the face of Jews. Absolutely cowardly. Why is that? Because Jews have strong allies in the United States and also in the UK. So this is the purpose of the United Nations, to enforce the victory of the Allies in World War II, and to keep the world going along the lines that they want it to go, that these victors want it to go. In 2007, the Norwegian Nobel Committee awards the Nobel Peace Prize of 2007 conjointly to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and to Albert Gore for their efforts in collecting and diffusing knowledge on climatic changes induced by humans. So that's their style. And finally, in 2010, the General Assembly of the UN created UN Women, the United Nations entity, a special organization, I guess, for gender equality and the empowerment of women. If they haven't done it already, they'll be doing the same for homosexuals. Now, in the beginning, the UN was built on the idea that it would prevent conflicts between nations and make future wars impossible. Well, that's what the League of Nations was supposed to do, and it failed, and certainly the UN has failed also, but they keep going because there's nobody new come along, new big kid on the block come along to push out the Allied powers, and so they're still in control. About the UN building itself, in December 1945, the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives, by unanimous votes, requested that the U.N. make its headquarters in the United States. The U.N. accepted this suggestion, my oh my, and after considering several sites accepted the $8.5 million donation from John D. Rockefeller Jr. that was tied to a parcel of land beside the East River in Manhattan. They wanted it to be in New York City, and they got the Rockefeller family to donate that land. We know that's where the Jews are, so that really does show their active role and their powerful role in this from the beginning, always using their money to buy their way in. And so Heinrich Hertel tells us about the Nuremberg Tribunal that the Allied prosecution's chief goal was the condemnation of the Germans for crimes against world peace. In order to do that, their goal was to make Germany responsible, totally responsible, for all the terrible things that had just taken place in the world during this period from 1939 to 1945. And in order to do that, they had to invent crimes that were not crimes at the time they were carried out. And this they did. The U.S. Chief Prosecutor Jackson is on record during the proceedings as saying, quote, "The Allies are still technically in a state of war with Germany, although the enemy's political and military institutions have collapsed. As a military tribunal, this tribunal is a continuation of the war effort of the Allied nations," unquote. This is from Volume 19, page 397. So, saying this, he has confirmed that the real goals of the trial can only be attained through force, and with the transgression against international law by inventing crimes after the fact. And this they did, with the help of the Russians. The Russians showed the way. My point is that force has been used all along. It's always been force, although the attempt is there to hide it in the velvet glove, to make it appear that it's coming for reasons of economic necessity, and also now of morality. Frau Merkel has actually said that one of the greatest challenges facing Europe in the coming years is that of agreeing on a unified European right to asylum. Now, what does that mean? Whose right to asylum? Well, we're seeing evidence of that right now. Anyone's right to asylum, apparently. Europe is to be a place of asylum for the world's masses, just as at one time the United States was seen as a place of asylum for the world's masses. We know the saying that was etched on the Statue of Liberty after it had been erected for some time. It was added from a poem written by a Jewess about, "Give me the world's unwanted masses." And the United States had to impose immigration restrictions, but they, in the last century, have been eased quite a bit. So while we are seeing it as suddenly we have this terrible problem with immigration, the immigration has been a part of the plan all along. We see it in the fight against Hitler, fight to the death against Hitler to destroy his view of the world altogether. And we see it in the formation of the United Nations and in the Nuremberg Tribunals that are set up now as the ultimate in international law. And so to illustrate a little bit the reason for World War II and the reason for the fight to the death, the unconditional surrender, the need for the unconditional surrender of Germany, I want to go to some excerpts, some quotes from an article currently posted at the Inconvenient History Journal by Ralph Raico, R-A-I-C-O, on Winston Churchill. But there are some very good quotes from that, which I want to use here. The first one is that Raico writes that Churchill himself never bothered to conceal Roosevelt's role as a co-conspirator. In January 1941, Harry Hopkins, who was Roosevelt's closest aide, and some say the real power behind the throne, visited London. Churchill described him as, quote, "the most faithful and perfect channel of communication between the president and me, the main prop and animator of Roosevelt himself," unquote. This quote that I'm going to give next is taken from Winston Churchill himself in his Volume 3 of The Grand Alliance, The Second World War. On page 23 and 24, and Churchill as writing. I soon comprehended Hopkins' personal dynamism and the outstanding importance of his mission. Here was an envoy from the president of extreme importance to our life. With gleaming eye and quiet, constrained passion, he said, "The president is determined that we shall win the war together. Make no mistake about it. He has sent me here to tell you that at all costs and by all means, he will carry you through, no matter what happens to him. There is nothing that he will not do as far as he has human power." End of Hopkins' statement, quoted by Churchill. Then Churchill writes, "There he sat, slim, frail, ill, but absolutely glowing with refined comprehension of the cause. It was to be the defeat, ruin, and slaughter of Hitler to the exclusion of all other purposes, loyalties, and aims." Wow. In another place, Reiko writes, "When Churchill returned to London, he informed the cabinet of what had been agreed to. 30 years later, the British documents were released. Here is how the New York Times reported the revelations." This is from the New York Times. "Formerly top-secret British government papers, made public today, said that President Franklin D. Roosevelt told Prime Minister Winston Churchill in August 1941 that he was looking for an incident to justify opening hostilities against Nazi Germany. On August 19th, Churchill reported to the War Cabinet in London on other aspects of the Newfoundland Atlantic Charter meeting that were not made public. Quote, he, Roosevelt, obviously was determined that they should come in, they meaning the Americans. If he were to put the issue of peace and war to Congress, they would debate it for months. The president had said he would wage war but not declare it, and that he would become more and more provocative. If the Germans did not like it, they could attack American forces. Everything was to be done to force an incident." Unquote. Well, we know that the incident didn't come up until December 1941, and it was with Japan. That was the best he could do. Roosevelt couldn't get Hitler to respond to any of his provocations, and he was making quite a lot of them. Another paragraph reads, "A moral postulate of our time is that in pursuit of the destruction of Hitler, all things were permissible. Yet why is it self-evident that morality required a crusade against Hitler in 1939 and 1940, and not against Stalin? At that point, Hitler had slain his thousands, but Stalin had already slain his millions. But it has yet to be explained why there should exist a double standard, ordaining that compromise with one dictator would have been morally sickening, while collaboration with the other was morally irreproachable." Then, early in the war, Churchill declared, quote, "I have only one aim in life, the defeat of Hitler, and this makes things very simple for me." Unquote. Stalin, on the other hand, understood perfectly that the entire purpose of war is to enforce certain political claims. This is the meaning of Clausewitz's famous dictum that war is the continuation of policy by other means. On Eden's visit to Moscow in December 1941, with the Wehrmacht in the Moscow suburbs, Stalin was ready with his demands. British recognition of Soviet rule over the Baltic states and the territories he had just seized from Finland, Poland, and Romania. They were eventually granted. Throughout the war, he never lost sight of these and other crucial political goals. But Churchill, despite frequent prodding from Eden, never gave a thought to his, whatever they might be. His approach, he explained, was that of Mrs. Glass's recipe for jugged hare. Quote, "First you catch your hare," unquote. That translated to, "First beat Hitler, then start thinking of the future of Britain and Europe." Churchill put in so many words, quote, "The defeat, ruin, and slaughter of Hitler to the exclusion of all other purposes, loyalties, and aims." For instance, in May 1944, Eden protested to Churchill regarding the prospect of the communization of the Balkans. He said, quote, "We must think of the after effect of these developments instead of confining ourselves as hitherto to the short-term view of what will give the best dividends during the war and for the war." Unquote. This was taken from Charmley, a book on Churchill, titled Churchill, The End of Glory. Instead of adopting this approach, letting the two dictators fight it out, that is, meaning Stalin and Hitler, or, for example, promoting the overthrow of Hitler by anti-Nazi Germans, instead of even considering such alternatives, Churchill from the start threw all his support to Soviet Russia. Franklin Roosevelt's fatuousness toward Joseph Stalin is well known. He looked on Stalin as a fellow progressive in quotes, and an invaluable collaborator in creating the future New World Order. Roosevelt's attitude is epitomized in his statement, quote, "If I give him," meaning Stalin, "everything I possibly can, and ask nothing of him in return, then, noblesse oblige, he won't try to annex anything and will work with me for a world of peace and democracy." Well, Roosevelt's words are so nauseating because he himself wasn't working for a world of peace and democracy. He himself didn't want that kind of a world. Roosevelt's flattery of Stalin is easily matched by Churchill's. Just like Roosevelt, Churchill heaped fulsome praise on the communist murderer and was anxious for Stalin's personal friendship. Moreover, his adulation of Stalin and his version of communism, so different from the repellent Trotskyite kind, was no different in private than in public. In January 1944, he was still speaking to Eden of the, quote, deep-seated changes which have taken place in the character of the Russian state and government, the new confidence which has grown in our hearts towards Stalin, unquote. Eden wrote, and I quote, "Mr. Churchill's reply left me in no doubt as to the answer to my problem. So long, he said, as the whole of Western civilization was threatened by the Nazi menace, we could not afford to let our attention be diverted from the immediate issue by consideration of long-term policy. Politics must be a secondary consideration." It would be difficult to think of a more frivolous attitude to waging war than considering politics to be a secondary consideration. As for the human costs of Churchill's policy, when an aide pointed out that Tito intended to transform Yugoslavia into a communist dictatorship on the Soviet model, Churchill retorted, "Do you intend to live there?" Churchill's aim was not simply to save world civilization from the Nazis, but in his words, the, quote, "indefinite prevention of their," the Germans, "rising again as an armed power," unquote. So listeners, from the short-sightedness of Winston Churchill and the foolish nonchalance of Franklin Roosevelt, compared to the long-range planning of Joseph Stalin, we have one of the greatest blunders ever to come about in world history. It is directly responsible for the world we live in today. Yes, the Jews have played their role, a large role, and we need to understand that role. For example, we know that both FDR and Churchill had Jewish blood running through their veins, and Eisenhower also, probably. But we are the victims of historical lies by our own white racial people, by our own white leaders, and we are comfortable with those lies. That is our main problem. I believe we have to put more resources, focus, and energy into upending these lies and creating a truer history for our people to learn from than into continual over-intellectualized opinion pieces that are currently the mainstay of what is called the white nationalist movement. It's there to entertain, and entertainment is too much what we're looking for. Trying to understand the last 100 years of history is too much work. If that's the case, we won't be around much longer. Because this global new order is serious business. They intend to continue changing the world to their image. Since they have been successful so far, what will stop them from further success? We offer nothing close to equal seriousness. In fact, I'm shocked at the stinginess of the so-called truth community when it comes to offering financial support to the Holocaust revisionists in their very important work. And they, of all the truth tellers, are the most unemployable. So, the lies of history, that's where we need to put our attention. Thanks for listening. This is Carolyn Yeager with the Heretics Hour on Monday, October 5th, 2015.